Blog Talk Radio.
The truth is so far. Dying, crying, people out there hiding from the man-made rules. Hiding, fighting for the wrong war. The world is a very narrow bridge to travel on. Where this man is an old and foolish dream. If we put our trust in God, we're not alone. Cause nothing's real down here but Him. We don't believe in faith. We don't believe in money. We don't believe in power or your faith. We don't believe in thought from you to faith. Cause everything is made. And just because we trust. Yes, everything is the same, and just in what we trust. Hating, deceiving, people are so kind and nice that bother us all. Making, pretending, they know it all. Now feeling the meaning, you got to keep your hope you bear it, try to hold.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive and we're trying to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Terachim, instructions of mercies. This is now the 257th class of Soul Class in search of ancient, authentic Torah. And we just heard, In God We Trust, by blessed prayer partner and brother and spirit soul, and all the good things, Reb Isaac Baton, who actually is right now, as we speak, in the holy land of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. And he's there because he has now concluded a certain amount of prayers as leader of the congregational prayers wherever he's gone for the morning service, afternoon service, and evening service, and now is preparing to celebrate or observe, I should say, with a certain level of somberness and also an understanding that the soul is an eternal matter and that his father's soul will continue to go from strength to strength, Mechai Lo Choyel, in the upper regions of the Creator's upper wisdoms and mercies in the heavenly abode above in the world of truth. And last week, I spoke to a good friend of Yitzhak Baton. His name is Yitzhak Faker, also a friend of mine. And Yitzhak was in Jerusalem, Yerushalayim. Now, everyone knows it was pretty bitterly cold last week. And when Isaac told Yitzhak Fakiro that in Jerusalem we were staying at the hotel, that in fact it was hot and there was no air conditioning. So someone who heard the conversation between myself and Yitzhak Fakiro said, well, let's send some air conditioning to Isaac Baton. And he blew out some air and the cold vapor, you know, emanated from the mouth. Says, oh, that would be his air conditioning. Someone else said, well, tell Yitzhak or Isaac Baton when he comes back to Brooklyn, the way the weather's been, he'll have plenty of free air conditioning outdoors. Now, before we get the show really rocking and rolling and talking about what will be the subject matter, I want to introduce, after too long a discontinuation of dialogue with Dennis Ryan, our teacher, our student, and our advocate for the dispersion learning and internalization of teachings of Rambam. Good evening, Dennis.
Good evening, Don. And yes, I'm an advocate for people who want to know more.
And also, we now have our the pride of Brooklyn, our Ben Noach, Ron Williams. Good evening, Ron. And I tried to reach Ron the whole day, and he came through in the clutch. Ron, thank you for coming on tonight.
You're welcome. I tried calling you back, but I couldn't get through to you.
Well, I think you had me on the line that we're connected to the Blessed Blog Talk Radio. With that being
Good night, Dennis.
Hi, Ron.
And hopefully, in a moment or two, we might even have Booker T. Washington Business League President, Cartrell Gore, who told me we might even have a special guest rabbi from Flatbush, who I've never heard of, in terms of participating in our show. We've had Rabbi Goldsack occasionally, but we'll see what happens. But in the meantime, blessed is our Creator. We return blessed souls after a brief break again to vibe out on Genesis. In particular, we want to discuss Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, quote, "And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat. And she gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat." Oy vey, caught in the act. Original woman and man caught in the act of leading to consequences we are still dealing with as part and parcel of the human family experience, and this will hopefully lead to some deep dialogue. As well, we hope to vibe out as usual on some Chabad / Breslov Chassidus, Rambam, and a small biographical glance of this Torah giant, duties of the heart, path of the righteous gentle, compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition, and whatever else will come down the pipeline of real human time, live conversations. Hoping your loved ones can join us during this jam, not needing any spiritual quote unquote peanut butter to keep it all the humble efforts together above in a peaceful and pleasant manner down here on earth. That being said, I'd just like to reflect you gentlemen a nice experience I had today. I took my two children, we had a day off of course, thank God. Went to the Museum of the American Indian, National American Indian Museum, which is, it's only five stops from my house from Iriat Kesser Crown Heights off of Bowling Green. And as we were going up the steps, my children were saying, "Why would it be Bowling Green? There's no bowling. And we don't see anything green except for the green glass as you go out of that train entrance." Then we were happily surprised because I forgot how close it is. Basically, it's within like 200 feet, the museum, when you get off at Bowling Green in downtown Manhattan. And we walked into the museum and we started touring around the museum. And lo and behold, there's a wall of listing of all the Indian tribes that have dwelt upon the North American, South American, Central American continent. And one of the tribes was spelled C-H-U-M-A-S-H, which you could pronounce Homash or Chumash. So I just want to mention to everyone that I found that pretty surprising because Chumash is the Hebrew pronunciation for none other than the five books of Moses. So I was thinking about this. Were they a tribe that associated themselves with the five books of Moses? Probably not. But then later on in the photographic exhibits we saw later on in the museum, over about 100 years ago, there was the last of one particular tribe. Maybe some of you have read, I think it's James Fenimore, Last of the Mohegans, I think it's called. And this person's name was called Ishi, this American Indian, Native American Indian. Now, Ishi in Hebrew means my husband or my man. And the tribe he was from is called the Yehi tribe. Now, then we went to the gift shop, and I went up to the person who was working at by the cash register, and I mentioned these things to him, and he said that he had heard of such things, of some sort of correlations. And I had also heard, previous to my meeting with this counter person, who wasn't a Native American Indian, that there are certain chants within the American Indian tradition which have a similar sound to the Hebraic pronunciation of the names of God. Now, many, many years ago, over 28, 29 years ago, the Lubavitch Rebbe spoke about this, that there have been discovered ancient Hebraic writings inscripted on rocks. Now, I don't know what that's about. Congratulations. Congratulations, we went to the American Museum of the American Indians. I'm not sure, but that was a little glitch. Sorry about that, blessed souls. So the Lubavitch Rebbe mentioned that these ancient Hebraic engravings on the rocks were certainly not writings that were brought over by the Vikings of long time ago. So not that we're going to conclude anything, just throwing that up in the air that, you know, when one is not looking for some sort of divine providence, sometimes divine providence hits you in the face. And I don't know how to interpret it other than that, just that if one is just hoping and praying to see more lights in the creation, as the cashier mentioned to me, yes, more and more lights are being connected. And I said, yes, but he said more and more lights are being revealed into the creation. And I said, well, yes, that's true. I don't know how to connect all the dots personally, but we also understand there are some people who are trying to disconnect the lights, the different lights of consciousness. But that being said, I want to throw the ball into maybe the court of Dennis and then Ron about how perhaps you gentlemen have, we're not looking for something to occur in terms of awakening to another perspective. All of a sudden, boom, you were presented with a whole series of facts and data that kind of like, whoa, you know, I didn't expect to get there, but look what I accessed today. Dennis, any experiences you'd like to share with our audience?
Yes, the American Indian Museum is free. It's a
yes.
free museum, and it's paid by taxpayer money, and it's been paid for a long time. So anybody who comes to New York should go visit it. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
James Fenimore Cooper wrote extensively about the early Americans, especially in the New York area, their relationship with Indians, and the original settlers in the greater New York area. One other thing, you mentioned Bowling Green. Well,
mm-hmm.
Bowling Green existed for bowling. A green was what the English called a place where there was grass on a flat land. So we had that down there, and there's a park still down there that has a lot of grass and it's sort of flat. And they had outdoor bowling. They didn't do it indoors, but they had games and other entertainment out there on the Bowling Green area. So it has a meaningful label to it. But other than that, yes, there's a lot of knowledge overlapping, a lot of original languages in many parts of the world have similar names that are sounding almost like grunts because they didn't have formal languages. And it's an overlapping area where
mm-hmm.
I don't think it was intentional, but if it was, God bless us all.
Ron, any experiences in your life where you weren't looking to learn something, all of a sudden a series of events occurred right before your very eyes that you had to say to yourself, wow, you know, like I'm getting a message from someone. I might not be able to understand it, but yet there seems to be a message I didn't expect to get, and yet here I'm receiving a message this particular day. Did that ever happen to you?
Oh, definitely, but the problem with me is I'm not able to connect them most of the time, so it just... Yeah, you know, I just basically store them just in case they do connect. I at least know, I got a hint before.
Okay. So, gentlemen, we and blessed souls out there, I would like to talk about a concept of heart of flesh, and then we'll segue. Dennis mentioned he wanted to share a proverb with us, so hopefully we'll go into that. But I think this is a very important point to share with you all because I stumbled into this out of divine providence 2 weeks ago in the famous Frankel Shul here in Kesekron Heights, and it goes like this. A medical miracle took place recently in Haifa, Israel. Haifa is a coastal city on the Mediterranean in the land of Israel, where doctors removed an artificial heart from a patient after his own heart made an unexpected dramatic recovery. The patient, Chaim Abu Hazira, was diagnosed 2 years ago with myocarditis, an infection of the heart muscle. With his heart function reduced to 10%, capacity, the doctors implanted a left ventricle assistive device, LVAD, in his chest, a mechanical pump that is attached to the heart and takes over some of its function. 2 years ago, his heart recovered to such an extent that he no longer needed the device. In a complicated 10-hour procedure, cardiologists in the Carmel Medical Center removed the artificial heart, with his old heart beating like new. Chaim was finally free of the backpack and cables that he wore constantly and which held the battery that powered his LVAD. This event calls to mind the prophecy of Zechariah, quote, "And I will remove the heart of stone from your body and replace it with a heart of flesh." And although most of us fortunately have a functional heart of flesh, many people suffer from emotional numbness that prevents them from forming a true bond with others or sensing their feelings. Many are not truly capable of empathizing, loving, thinking about, or truly connecting with another person. Their emotional world centers around themselves and their own needs and feelings. In Judaic teaching, such emotional insensitivity is referred to as a soul illness, which those of us who are students of Rambam are well aware of this kind of term, soul illness. Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, founder of Chabad Chassidus and author of Tanya, referred to it as a timtum alev, or an obstructed heart that is closed off to spiritual sensitivity. Today, impairment in emotional sensitivity and empathy are disorders being studied medically and scientifically. In the past, the concept of intelligence was viewed solely in terms of logical or rational capacity. However, it has been increasingly realized that emotional intelligence is as important, and in certain aspects more important, to an individual's success and functioning. Throughout history, there have been a few outstanding individuals who seem to have escaped the affliction of a stony heart. They are blessed with extraordinary sensitivity and compassion, and their lives are a blessing to whoever they come in contact with. Imagine a time when all of us will reach that level and live lives free of ego, selfishness, and envy, as described by Maimonides, Rambam. This will be the reality with the true and complete redemption, when there will be no competition or envy, and all good things will be abundant for everyone. The deep-rooted sensitivity and love that we see they have within all of us will be revealed, and mankind will live in a state of perfect peace and harmony in the area of the Mashiach, of the Messiah. So Dennis, I know that you are versed in Rambam's teachings about soul illness, so I'd like to turn to you first about this whole idea of how can we encourage people to realize that we should seek this goal in life to remove our illnesses from our soul by doing what's right, and to whatever effort we can, even before redemption, to replace our heart of stone with a heart of flesh.
Our minds and bodies are interconnected. You cannot handle one without the other. Maimonides expressed this opinion over and over, in the sense that if you don't have a healthy body, can you really have a healthy mind? And if you don't have a healthy mind, can you really have a healthy body? Mm-hmm. Now, some people think they can get away with this. They take shortcuts. They may cheat here and there, but your well-being is important because your whole future depends on it. In the year 2000, I had a major heart attack. In the LAD area of my heart, which happens to be the biggest wall of your heart. But since then, my tissues around the heart have grown back a bit. Now, I don't call this a miracle. I just call it being on the right side of God, that you must continue on. But after a heart attack, I decide to change my life, change my way of living, change my way of eating and thinking. That's why I'm here today. So,
Hashem, thank God.
Well, he didn't want to take me, so I figure I have other things to do, and that's why I'm here on the radio with you today. So it's not wisdom, it's just learning to understand how God works. And if you don't feel it, then you're not part of it. If you're not part of it, then what are you doing? Creating a separation? We cannot have that. God gave us the minds and the body. We must continue to do what he intended.
Beautiful. Ron, the heart of flesh and the heart of stone. How can we get people to start thinking about these things in a way that's pleasant and peaceful and, you know, not to cause excessive anxiety in individuals, that all of us, and, you know, when we talk with people, not to say that they're the ones, but all of us have to ratchet up the sensitivity to do what we can, as much as we can, before the universe redemption, to make our hearts into hearts of true hearts of flesh.
I think I don't know the recent it is, or if it's basically just in very urban industrialized areas of the world, but I think I know we all have a heart of flesh, and deep down we're all caring. The problem is when we get into that survival mode where we feel we have to do whatever it takes to get ahead, and we have to be in front. And what happens, we stop caring for other people because we just look at them as baggage, or, they're going to hold me back. And honestly speaking, in front of us, we'll never get to the point we ever really want to reach. And instead of slowing down and caring for others, we're just still pursuing that infinite quest which we have of, success or whatever it is. I visited Italy a few years ago, and the south of Italy, all the way to almost Calabria, and everyone there, I didn't live there, it was 24 a week, but everyone appeared so genuinely friendly to each other. And, if you had a flat tire, people pulled over. They didn't have to call AAA or whatever, and they assist each other. I mean, I didn't understand much of the language, but I saw everyone was laughing and they were talking. I asked my friend, I said, they're related? No, this is how we are. And I'm like, wow, because in New York, you know, I mean, I myself on the freeway, I just look at a car broken down and I'm saying, I hope he has AAA, and I just keep going. Because
right.
This is basically the whole momentum in which we find ourselves in. So, it's just, you know, we just have to slow down and try to not focus on the survival mode and the living mode. And living means living with others, helping and being helped. So...
Beautiful. And I'd like to reflect on an experience I had within the last several months. My Rav, Rav Avram Taub of Borough Park, Brooklyn, New York, recently lost his mother, Rebbetzin Atzadekis, Maras Finkel Perel, daughter of Rav Yosef David. And I tried to quote, there's a tradition, you know, when in a Jewish family, when one of seven significant members of one's family, it's the mother or father or wife or son or daughter or brother or sister. If one of them passes away after the burial, there's a 7-day period of mourning where one basically does not go out into society and one is receives consolations. Now, I tried to read Rav Taub when I was here in America, in Brooklyn, and I was unable to, and I felt... You know, I had tried to, but we just couldn't connect. And when we came back, there are certain expressions that are made, but I couldn't make them anymore because the 7-day period was over. I did express my sadness and the great pain because his mother was a very special woman, as he told me before she passed on, and how much more so after she passed on. She said to me, "Don, I want to tell you something." I asked him how old his mother was, and he said she was 91. Then he paused and he said, "Don, I want to tell you something. A mother has no age. She will always be my mother. And at least I know now up in heaven I have one more advocate praying for my benefit." And that shocked me when he said that way, that one's parents, no matter even if they're in this world or they've gone to the next higher level of life, as Lubavitcher called it, you know, that type of sensitivity, one's mother or one's father is one's father, one's mother forever. I had not thought of that, you know, in those terms. And I have to admit, I have to open it, I'm not ashamed to say it, in the last year my parents have had a series of maladies. May the Almighty heal them speedily in our days, peacefully and pleasantly. And then today I spoke briefly with my mother, she had a better day than usual, but my father's had a pretty rough last two months. And I think what's motivating me to keep a positive attitude and try to, in my own personal expressions of being, trying to be a good son, is that we're not looking at the age at this point, that one's mother, it will always be one's mother, and one's father will always be one's father. And for me, that's made my heart a little less stony and I think a little more fleshly. Dennis, Ron, if you have any other further comments, we'll move on.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention something that when I first started working at the company which I am presently employed, and basically I'm company of Orthodox Jews, I was, you know, invited to the weddings, the hasnas, and the bar mitzvahs, all the happy occasions. Then someone, you know, passed away, and, you know, they told me that, you know, normally there's a practice called, you know, menachem avel, comforting the mourner. And it's a part of our tradition where we go and we, you know, pay our condolences. And I know back home we also have this where you go and you sit with the, you know, the deceased family, but it wasn't like an obligatory thing, a traditional thing. It was, you know, okay, it's a nice thing to do. And I'm telling you, I had a little bit of doubts on how to behave when I get there because I'm dealing with traditions I'm not aware of. And after being there and upon leaving, a friend said to me, "Ron, you don't understand how much this means to him, because he's like, we are coming from the world of the living and we are embracing him. Basically, we're also reminding him that he has to return to the world of the living, even though after this period of time has left." And I realized something, that even though it's tradition and it's something that you have to do, it's something that is required in our existence of, you know, we need a period of mourning, and then we recuperate from this. We enter the world. We really don't have this period. It's just, you know, just a formal thing, and then you're back in business again. And many people haven't quite mourned the loss of their loved ones. I lost my father back in the early 90s when we first came to America. And I will tell you this, I never even stopped really to mourn him because I was afraid of dealing with it. And honestly speaking, I've never stopped mourning since then till now. Mm. And I always feel it, it always comes back. And when it does, I always try to push it away because that's what we were, that's how we were basically back home. You know, okay, get over it and keep moving. And you never have this chance of really dwelling with it and then moving on. You know, and I have to tell you that ever since then, I mean, I had the unfortunate experience of going to a few women I come over, but now I go with a different attitude than I did in the beginning. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Dennis, any concluding
points? I take a little different view of this. Some people get mad at me, but I don't care. What happens is that we are imperfect and we are mortal. We are going to die because we can't live forever. Now, when someone dies, it may be a surprise. So be it. But the longer you live, the closer to death you are going to be. That's a fact, not a figment of anybody's imagination.
That's right.
We live to go to a higher level, closer to God, we believe, if you led a good life. If you did, it's called what we like to describe as heaven. Now, you even mentioned that you now have an advocate up in heaven.
But his mother is an advocate for Rav Taub, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a positive idea. If she's up there as an advocate, she's helping out. So the mourning should be short-lived because there's a positive impact here that you're describing. Now, to me personally, if someone thinks I had a bad life and I'm going to hell, God forbid, but if they believe that, then I believe they should cry for me because I'm going to be paying for my sins in hell. But if they think I led a good life and I'm going to heaven, then the bereavement should be short-lived because they should rejoice that I'm going to a good place. So we must look at this a little differently than how we feel. You can feel the physical loss, but it's human. But you got to remember, human is only part of our lives here. The other part is looking towards God.
Dennis, I agree with everything you just said. I believe it. I hear what you're saying, and I like what you just said. Now, could you take us into this proverb or proverbs you wanted to share with us?
Yes. What happens is for some reason somebody left the book there, and they said it was for free. So I looked at it, and I said, "Gee, let me read it." So what happens is I'm reading it, and this guy says, "How come the people who believe in God on the planet here are not speaking up for important things and events and things that happen on the earth? For some reason or another, they're being silent, or they're making believe they're part of the silent majority. But since there's so many people who do believe in God, they should be speaking up." And the reason why he wrote the book, because he has this thing from Proverbs 29:18. And it says, "Where there is no vision, the people will perish." Mm-hmm. At first you'd say, "Oh, vision, they can see." No, no. It's not just with your eyes, it's with your mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
And perish, if you don't believe in God or have some vision of the future, how long do you think you're going to last on this planet? I don't know, but everybody, it's like a roll of the dice sometimes. But if you know you have God on your side, you have some help. So anyway, he wrote this book, and that was to me that he kept saying that the proverb kept coming back into his head. There is no vision, the people will perish. Now, the other interesting thing that I found in the book, and I'm always learning as I go along, is that he mentions that the one phrase that's commonly used many, many, many times in both the Old Testament and the New Testament is, do not fear. Well, I guess if you have enough vision, you might not fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, is he referring to, I mean, there is a commandment that to fear the Most High, I mean, meaning not to break the relationship. And I think even Solomon, I think, wrote, or King David wrote, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. I think he's probably talking about fearing humans or fearing situations, to fearing the unknown. When if we know that God, who is the ultimate unknowable super being, so to speak, is beyond all the veils and concerns of the world, we really do have nothing to fear except for the Almighty, because...
Well, that's what President Roosevelt said. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. But yes, you're right. From a human viewpoint, if you have enough fear, what are you fearing, yourself or the future? That's why you need a belief, commitment, and faith, so that you don't go on the fear side. I agree with you, Don.
Ron, your take on this? If there's no vision, the people will perish.
Don, unfortunately, there is a vision of people perishing. The end of days recently, with the Mayan calculations, and the world is going to end, and people just bought into this, and I was just afraid of this mentality, this feeling, as if they were actually hoping it should happen. It was, I don't know, they were part end of the world parties. It was unreal, and
it
I'm
was?
Like, this is what they, this yeah, this is what you are envisioning, the end of the world. Because of some Mayan calculation, and unfortunately, I don't know. I think they just bought into the fact of what happens in the movies, and I don't know. But that was one of the things that kind of bothered me a little bit. So we have to also make sure we have the correct vision when we, otherwise, actual vision will cause us to perish.
Well, I mean, this whole idea of the Mayan calendar now being extinguished, which I'm happy to say that the world did not perish. The only thing that perished was hopefully faith in a calendar or a, I don't know what you would call it, a spiritual system, a theology, a religion, a belief. I don't really know the Mayan culture, but the fact that they had predicted the end of the world and didn't end, the only thing that ended was their calendar. And hopefully that the consciousness that they were, whoever is of modern Mayan, ancestry, or those who would like to promote that idea, instead of again, we didn't mention at the beginning of the show, we're trying to hopefully push a consciousness towards the fulfillment in some small finite. Molecular way of fulfilling what's written in Isaiah 45:18. The world was created to be a settled place and not one of chaos. And if people are going to be promoting an ideology that the world is going to perish, and this impregnates the minds of thousands, even my 12-year-old son just said, God forbid, the idea is so, utterly ridiculous to those who believe in God. We don't believe that the world that God has created shall be destroyed. A covenant was made with Noah and his sons and all of the creation that he would not destroy the world, in particular the entire world, by water. But we don't see any particular prophecies that talking about the destruction of anything except the destruction of spiritual impurities like hatred, jealousy, transgressions of the 365 negative commandments of the Torah, the seven Noahide commandments. We just don't see that. So, I believe in an eternal God, and that which is connected to eternal God should hopefully move on to levels of eternity. Again, we're not going to live like the eternal one, but as human beings, and as Dennis mentioned, if we invest ourselves in living good and hopefully sincere lives, that we will move into eternal mode at the proper time. The Almighty wants us to make us conscious of the fact we're now in eternal mode. Dennis, any comment on that matter?
Yeah, I would just like to conclude my part regarding this is that I believe the Mayans had no vision.
Well, I mean, listen, they had something. I mean, there must have been some profundity that it was. I mean, how old was the calendar? 3,000 years? 2,000 years? I don't know
about that. It's a little 2,500 or something like that, because
okay,
they weren't dating stuff when they created it, but they created a calendar and it didn't go past some date that we passed a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
So I would say their vision was limited.
Oh yeah, they had a good run. We'll give them that. You know, but yeah. someone who we're still going to get a lot of returns on is Rambam, Maimonides, physician, science, and philosopher, edited by Dr. Fred Rosner and Samuel S. Kotek, MD, as well. And therefore, we shall turn to Dennis. Dennis, what is our selection for this week?
We go to page 212, Don. The last paragraph.
Okay.
It says here, fearlessly he stressed the emotional immaturity of the multitude at Sinai in his treatise on resurrection. Maimonides noted, and this is a quote, "It is well known that those people to whom the Almighty wishes to have the Torah understood in their time adopted erroneous ideas. It was said of them at the end of 40 years of desert wandering, after they had seen all the miraculous acts of God, but the Lord has not given you a heart to know and eyes to see and ears to hear until this day." End quote. Maimonides explains that in the view of his immaturity,
Immaturity.
God did not tell the Israelites about the tenet of resurrection of the dead. Instead, he utilized the process of gradual understanding of new concepts. In the beginning of this chapter, I asked, are these messages of current relevance that can be obtained from the writings of Maimonides? Fox answered the same question. Fox is referred to here as M. Fox. I don't know anything about him, but that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Have we any reason apart from pure historical curiosity or antiquarian interest to study Maimonides with enthusiasm? Does his thought have any contribution to make to contemporary Judaism and to the resolution of religious dilemmas of contemporary Western society? Unquote. Fox answered these questions with a resounding alternative response. Affirmative response, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes like this. We can learn first and most importantly from Maimonides an uncompromising and fearless intellectual honesty in all matters having to do with religion. At a time when forces of closed-minded intellectual timidity have managed to gain a position of some prominence in certain Jewish circles, the example of Maimonides is of great interest. While protecting the integrity of the system of Jewish law, he left room for the intellect to develop its own understanding concerning the fundamental questions of faith. In his interpretation of the Bible, he battles against liberalist fundamentalism, finding his justification in the long-established tradition of non-literal midrashic interpretation. The law is necessarily fixed because the integrity of society demands that the precepts of the law must be obligatory. But the human effort to grasp the ultimate nature of things must, in Maimonides' view, never be totally constricted or suppressed. We must command patterns of behavior, and we slightly expect people to subordinate their private inclinations to legal norms. It is dangerous and self-defeating, however, to command conformity in the formation, understanding, and apprehending of ultimate philosophical or theological matters. Here the human mind must be left to find its own way. If by chance we were to succeed in preventing people from thinking, we should also rob them of what is essential to their humanity. And concluding, Maimonides, as a rabbi, physician, and philosopher, fought rigid, unchanging approaches to human needs. He identified such inflexibility as a negation of the spirit of Judaism and one that connotes insecurity and the fear of differing views.
Beautiful. And it's just how interesting how, from the perspective of Shkocha Protis or synchronicity, how you mentioned before about the idea of not to fear anything, and this week's reading from Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher, the first word was how the Rambam was fearlessly, he went into the emotional immaturity of the multitude at Sinai, which is a very important point because we have a within the Jewish community, that you can take the Jew out of Egypt, but can you take Egypt out of the Jew? Meaning, we're still, at some level, battling with a certain level of dealing within the constrictions of ourselves, the constrictions of the society, constrictions of the nation we live in, constrictions of the creation that we live in. Not that those are negative constrictions, but because perhaps we misperceive how those constrictions are coming perhaps to oppress us, when actually they're trying to, in the ultimate level, being a catalyst from the Almighty God to help us bring out our soul essence, our self-actualization. So if we're going to bring about our self-actualization, that means we have to thoroughly open up our minds to every reasoning. And I think in previous shows, going way back, that Rambam mentioned that when he quoted certain ideas, it wasn't the fact that he was concerned about who the source was, the Jewish, or say of the Noahide nations, but the fact of the authenticity of the applied wisdom as it applies to the subject being mattered. If the applied wisdom, the wisdom noted in the discussion, was verifiably true, then so be it. It didn't matter the source of the truth. And that was the type of the type of mind that the Rambam had cultivated with himself, and certainly was a living example of it. And this is a living example of not just for the Jewish people, but for all people, because Rambam wasn't doing it just because he was a Jew, although one can argue that, but because as a human being with a divine image, that he understood that it's not just a one people show, it's a human family experience. And that's why he had the open-mindedness to work with the Mohammedan philosophies, the Christian philosophies, whatever philosophies they are, and the art and the sciences and the Galens and the Hippocrates and the Socrates and the Aristotle. To him, it was all a matter of what can he use? I mean, no one's going to walk around and say, I'm not going to use a saw because the saw can also, you know, kill a person. But a saw was made to saw down a tree that you can build a house. No one's going to, I mean, obviously we know that a saw could be used to injure someone, but the primary use of a saw is to cut down a tree, maybe make a baseball bat, something like that, or to hone down a piece of wood to become a table. Ron, how do we encourage people to be fearless in their efforts to get other people to realize we can all grow more in our emotional capacities, and how we can all grow more in our sense of seeking out the truth, which means pushing our intellect and our emotions and our thoughts and our speech and our actions to whatever limit we can on a day-to-day basis, going from strength to strength each and every day?
I would think personally there's two modes that we have to address, where people just they're too quick to judge, impose judgment on others because they don't quite understand what they're doing, and fear, because when fear is involved, then you don't give the other person the benefit of the doubt. You're so afraid that what they're going to do is wrong or could be harmful that you don't even think things through before you address them or what they're proposing. And many times I found personally, because of my views on Torah, when I speak to people, is that they feel that, you know, you're being, first thing they feel is that, oh, you're being brainwashed. You know, before listening and trying to understand what is being spoken, because they're not familiar with Shefa Mitzvah and that of the views from the Torah sages, including the Rambam, they immediately push it aside as being you've been brainwashed. And I feel it's just the fear of them losing, I mean, realizing that probably what they've learned is not, you know, as accurate as they think it may be. And now this different viewpoint just scares them to even want to listen to begin with. So I find there's a lot of closed-mindedness. As much as we feel we've advanced, you know, in technology and everything, still on a spiritual level, a lot of people are still very closed-minded and, you know, just genuinely uninterested because of their fear.
Beautiful.
Don?
Yes.
What happens is fear is part of the human spectrum. What we don't know, we fear. It's a natural human reaction and part of our analysis that our brain produces. However, if you take it to the extreme, can you fear your own shadow? If you fear your own shadow, it isn't your shadow, it's you.
Yeah. I mean, the person who looks at a glass that's half full or half empty, the part that's half empty is probably because he drank the first half of it. You know, and if it's half full, it's because maybe someone got to it before him. So, you know, it's this and that. I mean, people are funny, people are wondrous, and people can be... I had a rabbi who once said that people can be so silly that they should walk around with a button that says, "Look at me, I'm quite silly." I think we're going to call in right now, joining us late. I think we might be calling in Booker T. Washington, Business League President, Cartrell Gore. Let's see if it's Cartrell. Cartrell, is that you? Trying to call him in. Okay. For some reason, I'm trying to get him in. And it seems to be not working. Hold on. Cartrell, is that you?
Can you
hear
me? Yes,
good evening,
me?
Sir. Yeah, I can hear you. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Shalom.
Yes.
Yes, Cartrell.
Yes. I guess you can hear me now.
Yes. We have Dennis Ryan on the line as well as Ron Williams. And Dennis, we have Cartrell. And Ron, we have Cartrell Gore on the line.
Welcome on board.
Thanks a lot.
Well, I think this is a subject you probably really sink your teeth into, Cartrell. We're talking about the idea that people can be inundated with fear, and that fear can cause them to be closed-minded, that fear can cause them to inhibit their intellectual, spiritual, and emotional growth and inhibit their ability to take positive action, speak positively. How can we encourage people to reduce their fears and to try to live the best life as possible in a way that's good for themselves, of course, but also good for the communities they live in?
I had a secretary once, and she was only 4'11". And she was an excellent secretary, but I think she feared too easily. And I took a chance. She once got a bomb threat while we were working.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her to ignore it. And I was right. Nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
But she jumped up and she was very frightened. But she's a very timid woman, unfortunately. You know, maybe she was pushed around as a child. I don't know. But it just seems that I just think that she lived her life in fear of being attacked, and she was only comfortable in an environment in which she grew up. You know, anything else scared her. You know.
Well, we could be talking about someone who was traumatized. That's a whole different ballgame. I mean, I have a distant relative that was shell-shocked from being too close to a mortar that exploded by him in World War II, and he was basically in a walking vegetative state for the rest of his life. So I kind of hear that because in my field of mental health, I deal with people who've been traumatized, and sometimes when the trauma gets too physically, when there's too much physical stimulation in the negative sense, it can lead to that unfortunate type of paralyzing type of consciousness. But listen, you've broken too many barriers, Cartrell, in your life, going on, serving on with reserves and getting one degree, another degree. I mean, was there any point where perhaps you felt that you overstepped your borders and maybe you should you know, chill out a bit and just stay contented where you were instead of accomplishing what you have accomplished in your lifetime, intellectually?
Not at all. But I was a very, very slow learner, to be honest with you. I mean, it took me 10 years of intermittent study to earn my first college degree. And I didn't even particularly, after a few years, I just started taking courses. And then one day I said to myself, I've been taking so many courses, maybe let me see if I can get another degree out of this. And I found out that 9 more courses in one school and 6 more in the other, I could have 2 more degrees. And fortunately, the Department of Education pays me for the education that I amass, not the education that I apply. So it worked out good for me there. So I just kept on getting, then I had to get a degree to keep my, a master's to keep my job in the school system. So I wound up having 4 degrees, of which I get paid for 4. And then I got a 5th one, on which I have not yet gotten paid yet. For that, I have to get a promotion. I have to get a promotion because I have a master's in school administration. I won't be paid on that one until I get a promotion.
May the promotion come soon. So with that being said, gentlemen, we're going to move on, get a little biographical sketch on Rambam in terms of how did he regard the prophets and prophecy. And this is, I'm pulling from the teachings of Maimonides from Jacob S. Minkin. In his introduction, that he anticipated the subject of prophets and prophecy, which Rambam was to treat in his Guide to the Perplexed with great thoroughness and psychological insight. He held up Moses, the man of God, who heard the voice of Sinai, as the greatest of prophets, not only by reason of his moral and intellectual attainments, but because he received his communication directly from God. Maimonides actually started his contemporaries, we're talking about the rabbinical contemporaries, by his declaration that which the Israelites heard at Sinai directly from God were only the first 2 commandments, and that through the medium of an impersonal voice specially created for that purpose, like an angelic voice, the rest of the 10 commandments, I mean commandments 3 through 10, were transmitted to Israel, and then the entire Torah was communicated to them by Moses. So Moses became the intermediary. The Israelites heard the first 2 commandments from the Most High. The next 3 through 10 they heard through an angelic voice, and then after that, Moses instructed the rest of the Torah to them through prophetic insight, what the Most High taught him. So Maimonides drew a clear distinction between Moses and the other prophets, a distinction determined not by his greater wonders and miraculous deeds, but by reason of the fact that he was always in possession of the Spirit, of course, the Spirit of God. He was the man of God. He experienced God always. He was his chosen instrument, at once the revealer of God, the liberator and lawgiver of his people. Then there's Maimonides, the philosopher and ethicist, as he expressed in his Elements of his commentary, which talked about, I should say that Maimonides was in his element when his commentary in the Mishnah Torah reached Perkei Avos, the Ethics of the Fathers, which included in the 4th of the 6 divisions under which the Mishnah is arranged, where he could display the whole wealth of his thought on the moral and philosophical content of Judaism. What could have suited better the moral and ethical temperament of the man who always looked for the inner substance of Judaic teachings than the pithy, sparkling sentences of the chapters of the rabbis, which tersely sum up the ideals of Jewish life and conduct. In the Mishnah, says Israel Abrahams, in the annotated edition of the Daily Prayer Book, quote, "There is no distinction between the legal, the ritual, and the moral. All these ideas regarded as indissolubly, if I'm pronouncing it right that time, associated in the whole body of religious thought and practice. But the Avos, the ethics of the Father, is more consistently ethical than the other tractics of the Mishnah. If we employ this objective in the restricted sense now usually attached to it, so highly were these chapters regarded by the Jews because of their elevated thoughts and magnificent phrasing, that already in Gaonic times, which is about 1,000 years ago, plus they were introduced into the prayer book for recital during the summer months of the year in a custom which persisted to this day. So even although we do have a lot of law in Judaic lifestyle, Rambam saw, and I guess his emphasis led to the institution of these ethical teachings that it should be part and parcel of the observance of the Sabbath, which is a time of tranquility, generally speaking, for those people who observe the Shabbos. And one might say, well, why do I have to think about ethics? Let me say, oh, I've had enough for the week. No, but precisely when the mind is in a state of tranquility, which Rambam certainly and all spiritual guides do up until this day of any faith, is that the mind and the person's persona should try to strive for a sense of tranquility that one is on the right path. It doesn't mean the path will be easy, but one, at least in the inner core of one's fiber and being, knows that if one is going sincerely in the way of how they understand their God, hopefully the God of creation, and not a false deity, but hopefully they're following the one true creator of the creation, they should be able to deal with these teachings. And in that spirit, Rambam wrote his explanations, which eventually we're going to, I think that it will behoove us after we move on from this book or the other teachings about Rambam, that we'll move into his elaborations on the ethics of the fathers and the Perkei Avos. Ron, any comments on Rambam and ethics of the fathers you'd like to share with us?
Jewish law deals with the laws that the Creator gave to the Jewish people concerning how he wants them to interact with creation. But then there's the ethical laws dealing with how you interact with each other, and the ethics of the fathers, you know, what I've acquired from that was the dealings between man and man. And many times you find, sometimes, unfortunately, people who are, you know, very religious, they are so caught up with their religious activity, spiritual activity, dealing with the relationship with God, that sometimes they tend to ignore their relationship with their fellow humans. Mm-hmm. And that moral code is just to remind us that, hey, even though, you know, we have a commitment to the Creator, we also have to deal with our fellow man in a just and upright way. And so I see why, you know, the Rambam, you know, constantly remind us and actually incorporate this into the study. And on the day of Shabbat, which is a day where you're dealing direct, it's a day of a spiritual kind of an environment where you're interfacing with creation on a different level, you're reminded that you still have to deal with man in a just and upright way. But anyways, Don, I'm sorry, but I have to run. So I must say good night to you and to Dennis and to Cartrell. You guys have a great week.
Lila,
be well. Thanks.
Take care, Ron, and hopefully we'll be in touch this week. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to take a musical break. And I lost my music, so I think we're going to, let's see here, we're gonna connect with a song by a good friend, David Dome. We usually conclude the show with him, but I thought that this song would be appropriate now. And the song is about, let's see here, it's about, I think it's about 4 minutes. So let's play Reality Sometimes by David Dome. Enjoy, everyone. Thank you. Yes, and that's Reality Sometimes by our good friend David Domo, who tries to help us get home. Let me just, we have to quiet down the music here. Hold on.
Don?
Yes?
I'd like to just take a minute out to say something about the Guide to the Perplexed regarding prophecies that Maimonides wrote. I was always a little fuzzy about what was a prophet, what they prophesied. How did it fit into the scheme of things of life? But Maimonides defined the Minor, Major, and Moses as being separate groups, and he gave a very definitive explanation as to their human part and their spiritual part. And Moses, he said, was special because he was the only one who had direct contact with God. Everybody else below Moses had indirect contact with God. But to sum it up, he also said, and he surmised at the end of this detailed explanation, is that we will never come to another time in the history where we're going to have prophets anymore.
That's interesting, because in his code of law, Mishneh Torah, he said that a prerequisite for the revelation of the Messiah, that we see a restoration of prophecy. So I don't know how to connect those dots in terms of what he cites in the Guide to the Perplexed, because I do know in terms of what would be considered more authoritative in his Mishneh Torah, which his code of law, his collation of the oral and written Torah traditions, that it would be a more authoritative sense from the Rambam perspective that for whatever reason he wrote that in the Guide, that his legal rulings would overrule his philosophical perspectives. And I don't know how to... It's something in my lack of understanding, because I haven't learned the Guide to Perplexed as I should. And I'll be honest with you, I could learn a little bit better the Mishneh Torah. That's all I can respond to. Maybe one day we'll have a rabbinic commentator on the show who is an expert both in Guide to Perplexed. So it's very hard to find those type of people these days. There are plenty... There are... Because a lot of Rabbanim are very shy away from from Guide to Perplex, but there are more than a handful of rabbis. In fact, I will try to take upon myself without a vow to ask some rabbis in my community about that, and maybe I can get an answer that could be a more proper response than the one I just gave. That's what I can how I can respond to that. With that being said, I'd like to move on to we've sourced this book before. It's called Erek HaPaim, which means long and angering, a book about patience by Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who lived from 1772 to 1810. And we're talking about the patience which is required in terms of maintaining a peaceful household. That's where, you know, a man and woman are living together, and hopefully they have some children. And Rabbi Nachman goes on to say that even if one, say, would have a desire to divorce his wife for the fact that he has borne out from her, he has tolerated from her, in truth, many different types of sufferings, but who knows, perhaps his second wife will even be worse and more evil to him than the first one and will make his life even more bitter, that we see, according to majority, that when a person marries a second wife, it's almost like a person is even more bound to the commitment of the relationship, almost like a donkey to a yoke put upon its back. Now, of course, there are exceptions to the rule, but Rabbi Nachman, according to his time period that he lived in, you know, divorce wasn't as prolific as it is today. I mean, I think in America it's close to 50%, maybe it's past the 50% mark. I know the Torah observant community, it's not 50%, but the numbers are rising. Unfortunately, not because of the. I think that we have been overly influenced by the disposable nature of our society, whether it be watches, televisions, computers, or even relationships. But in particularly, our sages have warned us that a person should strive not to divorce his first wife, and that the consequence of the divorcing of the first wife, regardless of the circumstances, causes a certain type of heavenly outcry, where actually there's some sort of spiritual dimension of spiritual tears falling from heaven. And another place in the Talmudic tractate said that a person will only truly find a certain sort of peace of spirit, a settlement of spirit from his first wife. And so this is the advice, that a person should be willing to absorb in his life all the little, you know, differences and the arguments and even the anger, and if it caused pain, and rather to deepen his mind and his thought process continually into what his lackings are, and even with his wife that he has sufferings that he bears from her, that he should think that all of his schemings should be how to be spared from her. In truth, this is not the advice, but rather a person should ask from the Most High in mercies and with supplications to make the situation better. Now, I heard word of mouth in the name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe that when it comes to a lack of peace between man and woman in a man-wife relationship, most of the time the man is not on the right side because he has certain expectations. Now, again, every male-female relationship has its own unique dimensions. The husband comes in with his unique environmental upraising, and the wife comes with her own unique upraising. But in general, as a general category, Rabbi Nachman is saying that basically, guys, marriage is not the Garden of Eden. Marriage is work. And I once heard from a rabbi in my yeshiva, he once told us as students, unmarried students, he said, "You guys think I like taking out the garbage every night? No, but you know what? I take it out. And you know what?" And he basically implied to us, "It doesn't hurt me to take out the garbage." So a man can be insulted. A man can be, his feelings can be hurt by his wife. But the main thing is, one should know that there's a reason why one was given one's wife, to love her and to cherish her. Recently I saw something that this is a wisdom that I saw posted on Facebook, that a woman was created from man's side, not from his head to be on top of him, not from his belly to be below him, but to be his helper, that she can nurture and he can protect, that she can help him and he should love her. So there's a lot, again, I'm not trying to give anyone definite instructions of how to conduct their marriage life, or someone who's maybe on the precipice of getting married, but to consider that if one has made a commitment to one's loved one and there are some difficulties, hey, it wasn't written in the Bible that life is a bowl of cherries. And sometimes if one gets to those cherries too quickly, one gets to the pits too quickly. It's better to go through the process of building your own garden and your own tranquility and your own house with your initial wife in a manner that, despite the difficulties, deep down inside, you understand it is by divine providence that you two different souls, two different bodies came together. And you have children, you became even more of an expression of one flesh, and hopefully the relationship will grow despite the difficulties. And hopefully this will contribute to a general sense of peace in the house, even on those rough, cloudy days. Dennis, you've been married for quite a long time. I'm sure you can comment on this.
What happens, Don, is that every human makes their own life.
Yep.
And it is what you want it to be. If you want to be a happy, positive person, you can do that. If you want to give other people a hard time, you can. If you want to nitpick, you can. However, let's get back to this bowl of cherries. We have people today, especially in the United States, that go around cherry picking. That is, they pick out the cherry in the bowl that they want.
Right.
Which they think may be the ripened one or the best one or the tasting one or anything. But by doing that, they sometimes forget about their previous commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a vow or you make a commitment, you're not cherry picking. You are accepting on an absolute basis. And if that's the base, if that's the foundation that you did or started on, you should continue along that. You cannot come out with reasoning and say, well, that was a long time ago, and I want to pick a different cherry from the bowl. It doesn't work that way. You're only fooling yourself. Again, you make your own life. Do you want to keep your commitments that you made? Do you believe in them? Do you have faith? Are you going to continue them? It's very easy to say, that's too much work. That's too hard to do. I want an easier way. The Bible never said there's an easy way and there's a hard way. It's the way you pick it, but you must live with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Cartrell, any commentary on the matter? Cartrell? Okay, it seems that we have Cartrell on hold. Let's just see here. Cartrell?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Any commentary on this matter?
All right, I just wanted to say that it was a lovely song. However, the voice was a little bit too soft. It was hard for me to hear what he was saying. It was hard for me to make out his lyrics. That was one of the things that I was listening to. I had to strain my ears to figure out what he was talking about. I couldn't get the entire message.
Mm-hmm.
Something about push coming to shove. And what else was there? I can't remember right now a few other things.
Well, I've heard this song before, but I was more focused on preparing for the next material that I was presenting, which I just did. The idea of relationships. I mean, what you know, we have a high divorce rate in America. I don't know what it is around the world, but because people, you know, they're too quick to discard their partner. What do you think we can do to try to encourage people that despite difficulties in relationships, unless they are injurious to the point of no return, that it's worthwhile to realize that you know, it doesn't say that we will be promised a bowl of cherries in this life, but rather we should try to, you know, uplift ourselves and our environments.
What comes to mind is I happen to know a few, more than one couple, at least maybe two or three, who are divorced and they're still staying together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of my coworkers, for some reason, I don't know, maybe because of their daughter, but she's been divorced a number of years, but she her husband, they're still living as one intact family unit, she, her husband, and their daughter. I don't believe the husband is self-sufficient. I don't believe the husband is self-sufficient. That could be something to do with it. And I also know other couples who love each other deeply, but their relationship improved when they got divorced. If you were to see them, you'd think they were newlyweds.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a very happily divorced couple. I mean, why can't you stay married? I also know two people who have been living together maybe since the late 70s. And I've been wondering, if they've been together all this time, why don't they get married? But then again, it's not my business, you know.
Right.
I was sad to see some marriages break up. But it's just, I mean, and one part of the couple got remarried. I don't know which way they made turns. I mean, like, I had a cousin who was very, very close to me. He was like my twin brother. But as we got older, we got distant, and we just got distant. There were certain philosophical differences between us, you know. Unfortunately, he died at 43 because he wouldn't stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
But
sorry to hear that.
Some people who are very dear to you, like even friends, you just grow apart. There's not the same things there that keeping you apart. Maybe friendships grow apart, the marriages grow apart, because what kept you together is no longer there. I've never been married.
Mm-hmm.
But I have some friends who have been, I'm still friends with the very first one ever made, back about August 1956. And we're still friends after all these years. We haven't stayed in contact all those years. Our paths just keep crossing. And some people, you know, we're still friends, but we don't speak very much. One person I know, I gave her a call every third birthday. I mean, she was like a big sister to me when I was in college.
Right.
But there are certain problems that I have with her, with other aspects of her life, and aspects about my life are not compatible. So I give her a call once every third birthday. And because had I met her today, I probably would not have associated with her. But just there's certain other things. I helped her clinch the man that she did marry. What happened was she asked me to spend the weekend in her guest room, and then invited the man that she wanted to marry over for dinner. And I think the sight of me made him so jealous, he proposed, and I was very happy to help her win the man that she wanted to marry, because he probably was thinking he might lose her to me, which was not at all in the cards. I didn't know. We were not a romantic. We were just good friends. We were like a brother and sister team. And that was back in 1975. And they got married, I think, in 77. And they're still together. The kids, they probably have grandchildren now. I haven't given her a call to ages, but I would guess by now she's almost, her daughters have grown up. But as far as I know, they're still together.
Thank God. Beautiful. Okay, we're just going to move in because it's been a while since we did this type of format on Soul Talk. We're not going to be able to cover from Path Towards the Gentile or Compassion Towards Humanity in the Jewish tradition. I just want to read a very brief paragraph from Duties of the Heart, Ben Abachi, who did precede the Rambam, historically speaking, in terms of prolific Judaic thinkers. And Rabbeinu Abachi writes the following concerning Duties of the Heart. If, however, you possess intellect or intelligence and insight, and through these faculties of intelligence and insight, you are capable of verifying the fundamentals of the faith and the foundations of the commandments which you have received from the sages in the name of the prophets, then it is your duty to use these faculties until you understand the subject so that you are certain of it, both by tradition and by force of reasoning. If you disregard and neglect this duty, you fall short in the fulfillment of what you owe your Creator. So this can be demonstrated in two ways, but we're only going to go upon the first way. First, from the verse, from quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 8 and 10, if a case should prove too difficult for you in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, between leprous mark and leprous mark, or other matters of dispute in your courts, you must act in accordance with what they tell you, meaning the courts that you are dealing with. Of course, this is when Israel had sovereignty in their own land. But you see, too, there's a universal instruction that can be learned out here, that one goes through the stages of one's life, and one sees that there is a matter that they've strained their intellect to whatever degree they could, and their faith as well, and yet still cannot come up with an answer. They should be able to humble themselves, to go to elders, or to go to experts, or go to whatever field of endeavor they need to go to, where there are experts in those fields, to try to get proper advice. Dennis, any take on this, the idea of using our innate human intelligent insight, but at the same time, too, being humble enough to go to others for guidance when we do need this guidance?
Well, if you're learning and you're trying to find out, you'll understand that nobody knows everything, and that more heads working together can produce a better effect. Then again, we have, let's say, the wisdom of Solomon. Should we split the baby under any condition? We have these common sense thoughts that people have handed down throughout history. The Bible is full of them. They're there. If you don't like them, then you're cherry picking. But don't worry about it, because your brain is your best friend, and it is God-given, and it should help you if you use it.
True. That being said, we only have about 7 minutes to go, so we'll try to be as compact as possible and hopefully get some reasonings from Dennis and Ron, Cartrell and Dennis. So quoting now from Genesis 3:6, and perhaps next week hopefully we'll continue on this verse, because there is some juicy tidbits to be learned out from here. The verse reads as follows: the woman saw that the tree was good to eat and desirable to the eyes, and that the tree was attractive as a means of wisdom. She took of its fruit and she ate, and she also gave it to her husband with her, and he ate it. Now, what happened previously is that the serpent had pushed her against a tree when she had already told him that we were told by God that if we touch it, we would die. So the serpent had pushed her against a tree and said to her, certainly you shall not die. So what this verse is talking about is that, first of all, that she saw the tree was good. Now, from the inner dimensions of Torah, it's for sure that her seeing was demonstrating how we must use our gift of sight properly. Our misdeeds, our lack of proper action, usually begin with looking where we should not look. We can rationalize that there's no harm in only looking, but looking leads to desire, desire leads to action, and action leads to misleading others into misdeed, just as Eve convinced Adam to go along with her. No matter how spiritually advanced we are, we must not delude ourselves into thinking that we are immune to the lure of sight. Are any of us more pure than Eve, who was created directly by God? Let us rather direct our eyes to positive and sanctified sights, and teach our eyes to focus only on the good. Dennis, any take on that, how we should utilize our eyes for looking at those things which are truly good?
Well, let's get to the heart of the matter, Don.
Yes.
What happens is all humans are sentient beings. Mm-hmm. Sentient meaning that we have senses and feelings.
Yes.
So what happens is we cannot be totally objective. We like a color or we don't like a color. We like a taste, we don't like a taste. If that seems good, it may be good. But if it doesn't seem good, how do we know it's not good? It could be good as well. Taste,
right.
All our senses are going. But this is also a double-edged blade to all humans. It can be our downfall. If you rely too much on your senses, you're not relying enough on God, because you're thinking of the physical world and only the physical world. Yes, we can feel, touch, and things look good, and you shouldn't touch the tree. But since we're sentient beings, we have feelings. And this is what the devil loves to take advantage of, because we don't know where to cut off our feelings and say enough is enough, and I believe in this, and I don't want to hear about that the color red is better than the color blue, because it has nothing to do with you and God or your love for God. It doesn't come in colors. It doesn't come in numbers. It doesn't come in tastes. Those are pleasures that the humans enjoy when they're on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be on the planet forever. We already talked about that. You're going to die at some time. And you can't take all your colors and all your senses with you and all your tastes. They become meaningless as the older you get. Why? Because you realize that you're shooting for a goal other than something that feels, looks pretty, and tastes good.
Beautiful. Cartrell, you take on the what people take for granted, the effect on their psyche and their speech and their thoughts when they look in areas where they should look, as opposed to dedicating themselves
and
to look at things.
And also, you don't know what you have until you lose it. And sometimes you need someone from the outside who's objective to tell you what you have and to take care of it. That's another issue that we have in life.
True. Well, gentlemen, believe it or not, the hour and a half has basically come to an end, aside from the last one we want to segue with. I want to thank profusely you gentlemen, Cartrell Gore, president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, and our Rambam teacher, student, advocate, and advocate, Dennis Ryan. Of course, we had our Ron Williams, our Ben Noach scholar. This is Donzitz Goodman, your local cyberspace Torah activist, wishing everyone a beautiful week, and hopefully things will be a little bit warmer in Boiler Room, Brooklyn, New York, and the rest of the creation, because last week it was like an ice ball here in Brooklyn, and I guess the boiler broke down in Boiler Room, Brooklyn, and hopefully this week we're supposed to get a little bit warmer weather, but in the meantime, let's warm up our hearts. Let's try to rededicate ourselves to the conscience towards establishing a heart of flesh to hopefully work away through the waters of wisdom, whether it be divine wisdom of the Torah or the secular wisdoms of the creation, that our heart become a little more fleshly. And please, blessed souls, do not overestimate the negativities within yourself, and don't underestimate the good within yourselves, because each and every one of us, from the beginning of creation, as mentioned in the Torah, has a divine image, a Tzelem Elokim, which is no dream, to help us get home. And we're going to end now with actually a song by the cousin of Isaac Baton. His name is Shmuel Levy. He has a ben called Leviathan. And this is a song called Look Up Ahead. And again, this song is about not having fear, because if you're looking up ahead to the blessings of the Most High, you have nothing to fear. Take care, everyone.
All right. Take care, bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
There is a choice driving through roads where many calls echoed in songs for life. Dare to explore, knock on your door, may magic go, your heart will call. All peace that flaws will show it all. We're calling, roll up your hands, and don't be afraid. No voice is dragging you down. It's like a wheel turning around, waving the way, driving ahead for life. Don't you explore, unlock your door, refreshing your mind. There you will find answers for truth, all kinds of truth. We're calling, roll up your up ahead.